Hey everyone, we have a great guest today, Alap Shah, CIO of Lotus Technology Management, co-author of the Citrini piece, the 2028 Global Intelligence Crisis that got everyone talking about AI taking people's jobs and GDP growth, but an economic collapse. Alap, why don't you dive into it?
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me. Excited to chat about the ideas. I'll set up kind of the background quickly on myself and sort of how we came to here, and then happy to jump into the conversation. I'm a lifetime kind of investor and technologist. I've been in the public markets for 20 plus years. I've been building in AI for 15 plus years, and you know, have been using the LLMs very aggressively since they came out, both for myself and for my businesses. And you know, really saw a big step change in the fall when I really got into Claude Code and more kind of agentic coding interfaces. And the more I started using them and the more I started deploying them for myself in both investing as well as in the couple startups that I'm building, it became really apparently obvious that something was changing very, very fast. And as I started really thinking through what that meant for staffing within my own companies and the velocity that we were able to generate building things, it became pretty obvious that, you know, we weren't going to staff the businesses the way we had thought in the past. And really, you know, especially smart, kind of highly agentic folks could really cover the ground of many, many people, or what they could have covered a few years ago. And ultimately, you know, the realization that kind of drew me to write in a way that, you know, I haven't really written anything in 20 plus years, but kind of very excited to kind of share my ideas and really start a dialogue, was this realization that, wow, there is, you know, it's not the base case, but there is a real chance if agentic coding keeps doing what it does, or even if you just take where it is today and then give corporates 24 months to implement that, then, you know, we could end up in a situation where a lot of kind of typical white collar jobs that, you know, have been the sort of bedrock of our consumer economy could go away a lot faster than anyone expects. And so we wanted to kind of put the word out there in terms of, you know, one scenario that we saw that could happen to get folks talking about it. And then ultimately, you know, we're going to propose some solutions, which I think are, you know, not particularly novel, but, you know, want to put all in one place. With part three that we'll be coming out with pretty soon. So that's kind of the overall framing. Obviously, the markets took it, you know, got quite worried the day it came out. I think it was, you know, really a 24, 36 hour event, and then things bounced. But it does, I think, really underscore this idea that we are entering into completely new times. You know, volatility is likely to go a lot higher. People are very worried about this as a concept. And so I think, it was encouraging at the least to just get folks chatting about it and, you know, hopefully continue that dialogue.
Of what you outlined in your scenario, and maybe you can just help refresh some of the bullet points because there's a lot in there. What in that scenario do you have the highest conviction in coming true, or what you're starting to see? You know, you mentioned to me in a prior conversation, you are a technology optimist, but you've laid out this scenario that's quite doomerish in a way, but you maybe help refresh everyone.
You guys making a tizzy for a whole week.
Running around. I was, you know, I spent the whole weekend being scared. But yeah, maybe just help refresh us on some of the bullet points outlined in that Global Intelligence Crisis 2028 piece.
So the high level bullet point, I think the most important thing that we should all be focusing on is this idea that for the entirety of history, and especially, you know, over the last 20, 30 years, as we've become a services economy, the core input into, you know, our GDP output is human intelligence. You know, we are a services economy. That's primarily what we sell, is different forms of intelligence repackaged into goods and services. That led to, you know, our very flourishing, very large kind of consumer economy. The problem is we're now, for the first time in history, seeing this idea of AI, which we, you know, we synonymize with machine intelligence, as not a complement necessarily to human intelligence. In lots of places, it obviously is going to stay a complement, but there are lots of places where machine intelligence or AI now can become a direct substitute for human intelligence, and can become a substitute at, you know, 1/100th or 1/1000th the cost. And, you know, as we said in the piece, and I think people understand, like, AIs don't need benefits, they don't sleep, they can work 24/7, you could spin up as many of them as you need.
And now
all of a sudden...
Don't you think that, as in, I get my hair cut, it's clearly a service piece of work, and the person is not doing PhD level math as they're cutting my hair. Like, the framing that, hey, AI is very good at some things, and then therefore is going to displace a lot of other things, in some ways ignores the fact that the human intelligence that you're talking about that powers the service economy is actually a much more intuitive, fluid, kind of nuanced set of actions that are, you know, potentially extraordinarily challenging for AI to plug into. Not just intelligence matched with mechanical actuation, which is, you know, clearly on the timeline you lay out, that's not all going to happen. Also
2 years further.
Yeah, it's like the if the capital owners are getting extraordinarily wealthy because kind of like in the piece you lay out, it's basically like I'm spending, you know, $100 million on labor as an owner of a business, $5 million on AI. I shift down to like $70 million on labor, $90 million to AI. That sounds like deflation. That's scary. Now, just leaving aside that the $20 million on AI actually requires a lot more than that in CapEx. So there's more spend that's attached to that. But even within that context, it means that the person who owns the business suddenly has $15 million in surplus in some way. And they don't just, that has to go somewhere. So their profitability, they spend it on very expensive haircuts or very extensive, dog haircuts, or like that's the entire thing that happens all the way along, right? It's like, as in you make more, and then people have more to spend on things. And so then the economy expands. That's the way it works.
But what is the marginal propensity to consume for, you know, somebody who has a $100 million business compared to like a paralegal that lost, you know, their job?
Sure, but
like,
even if they, I agree.
Doesn't just put it in the bank.
Yes. But that, think about what happens when it goes into the bank. It doesn't just sit in the bank. Then it goes into a loan to pay for the data center that is needed to power the service that they're on selling to the customer that's buying it. Now, how does the data center get built? It does not get built by an LLM building the data center. You have to hire the people with the shovels and the people with the bulldozers, and you have to motivate in the power and plug in all the power. So it's not like the money just disappears in the bank. If you put it into savings, it goes into investment, and capital expenditures are actually a huge driver. It's the marginal driver of GDP activity right now. So it's not like
it's the marginal driver.
Sorry, go on.
It's the marginal driver because, you know, the consumer economy is very mature, and it's a very, very large part of our economy. I don't think you're saying this, and I certainly don't believe that, you know, if those jobs go away, the data center, you know, that business operator now has a bunch more money and they put it into, you know, into their savings and turn it into more data centers, that's ultimately going to be a net positive for the U.S. economy if, like, you know, 5% or 7% of white collar jobs went away. Because the problem is, you know, we have a very reflexive economy. We have a consumer driven economy. And so those folks.
But that's the whole point. You're acting as if like the mix of service versus kind of call it more of these blue collar works has to stay identical and the same. Whereas it doesn't. If I think where you're right is, if there is a tool that provides a lot of kind of like cost reduction and a certain kind of line item in all the labor that we do, then that individual kind of skill will be under cost, or call it competitive pressure. But then the other labor that sits in the economy is going to be able to capture the gains of the production that comes. That's just the way it works. It's not going to, it doesn't like disappear just because when the tractor got introduced, you know, that was probably put net pressure on labor wages. But by the way, where the labor wages got taken out was unmonetized labor. It was basically owner operator doing sweat equity. They have 10 kids, the kids work on the farm. They no longer needed to work because the tractor was there. So, and there's other circumstances where that's going to happen. If you look at the U.S. economy, we have $30 trillion in wages, GDP roughly. We spend, you know, $4 trillion driving without getting paid for it, basically, and implied labor costs. So there's all kinds of ways you have things that aren't measured in GDP that will get pulled in by technology. But even leaving all that aside, it seems like that the money that is being spent on AI still has to cycle through in some way. And if you're taking money that was previously kind of, as you say, sitting in notes and stuff like that, and then shifts into this big CapEx cycle, that's going to be economically good, not economically bad.
It's purely a question of kind of the timing, right? The problem is if you lose a lot of white collar jobs, are those jobs going to get taken up by data center building? Ultimately, there aren't that many folks that are required for that. It gets more and more sort of automated over time. And the underlying problem is just, you know, the tractor is the right example. And I think the difference is the tractor let humans do more. And we were at a point in our economy where we were very undeveloped. And so lots and lots of new jobs came out. I think
let me ask another.
What new jobs are going to show? Let's say 10% of white collar jobs, yeah, jobs go away from this. Let's say 30% do. What new jobs are going to show up that will take the baton when this technology, compared to every previous technology, can wholesale do what humans do rather than complement them like a tractor did?
But that's it. Wait a minute. One, it can't. I use AI agents. You use AI agents. I don't have one running right now, because if I could have it running right now, I would. But I have to check in like every 15 minutes to keep them spinning. So it can't displace all of it. I'm more productive with these agents.
We're not talking about all of it. It doesn't take, the labor supply demand curve right now is very, very fragile for white collar work. Doesn't take much AI to really upset that. Like 15, you know, you could, one really smart person just operating those agents every 15 minutes can probably do the work of three or four people now.
Also, using your own words that you've said time and time again, this is the worst this technology will ever be.
Sure. And I think it'll be three times better next year. Like, I do believe that. But the one, I think, way to think about the problem of this question, this conundrum, where are these jobs going to come from? Actually, there is a lot of unexploited opportunity out there that clearly megacap tech could be exploiting that it hasn't, because partly they have captured and are holding on to a labor resource that they've monopolized. And they don't have the management bandwidth to actually efficiently pursue all of that or to motivate that labor force. So you have collections of talent that are really underutilized. I mean, you can see the TikToks of the people being like, oh, I'm product managing, but I'm also in the swimming pool, you know, and they're not actually fully exploiting kind of their talent to release the number of products and features that they could that cleanly work. And it's a function of kind of like management ability and ability of people to ship, and the fact that they have such distribution advantages that they're effective monopolies. So they're not motivated to do so. If and as you say, and I do believe that kind of there is pressure, people are not going to hire inside those organizations because they're like, we have AI, we should be able to do as much. But the technology also allows people in much smaller teams acting much more nimbly to exploit those opportunities that have been unexploited by these entities. I think there's going to be an explosion in software developed. And the marginal software developer, as just somebody mechanically doing the job, probably isn't going to make as much. But the entrepreneurial opportunity for that software developer is much, much greater, because the barriers to like thinking of something that the world needs and launching it are much lower. And so you'll end up with a much broader kind of like explosion of productively delivering products and services in the software space alone. And it'll like proliferate across the knowledge workspace. So I think that's like, where do the jobs come from? The opportunities are obviously there. Why does one of my AirPods randomly stop working occasionally? It's because Apple's software, as good as it is, still should be better. And there's an opportunity for somebody to do a better job of that. But Apple's monopoly prevents them from really going after it. Now the marginal cost of going after, and maybe that's the wrong opportunity, but going after something like that is much lower. And so you'll end up with a kind of an enterprise creation explosion on the back end.
I think we're in violent agreement that that will happen. I think that was the genesis of this entire idea. I run startups and I can just see this in my own life. I think the problem is what happens downstream of that. So the problem in my mind is there are lots and lots of technology businesses and software businesses today that employ lots of folks. The new sort of unicorns that we're talking about that are, you know, being built today, you know, the trope that everyone's talking about is like the one person unicorn, right? I think we're probably pretty close to that. It might have already happened and we're just not aware of it yet, but it's going to happen very, very soon. And so the problem is, let's say, you know, of course the pie will grow, but it's not going to grow at some insane rate. And so, you know, GDP goes from 3%.
Yeah, no, but okay. So then this is the other, why won't it grow at some insane rate?
No, let me get that. Okay. So you know, things will grow. But, you know, if all these new software companies are going to come and take market share from Apple, right, from Google, and they're staffed at 1/10 or 1/50 of what these guys are in terms of revenue per employee, then, you know, until the unless like GDP just absolutely explodes, Google has to fire more people. Apple, or more importantly, like, you know, Salesforce or ServiceNow and folks like that have to fire folks. Those are all highly compensated people. And so that's part of the problem. Now, ultimately, the question here is like, what is AI going to do? It's going to massively accelerate productivity. That should lead to massively accelerated GDP growth. Now, the concern here, what we're trying to focus on and think about is, you know, should the productivity go really high, but the jobs really lag? You could have a situation where usually the way the macroeconomy should respond to that is you know, things are deflationary and, you know, prices go down and things can adjust that way. But prices don't go down in a normal environment. They're sticky. It's hard for us to go past a zero lower bound and really keep rates negative if that's what's required. And so that transmission mechanism of, like, you know, pre-AI labor to post-AI labor world, it's just very tricky. And so that's really what we're trying to kind of underscore here is if, like, we really as a society need to spend time thinking about that, monitoring it, and then coming up with a plan for what happens if the jobs go faster than we expect, including lots of startups taking more of that market share, but with very, very few people and a lot of agents.
It is interesting to, I mean, one, we've covered a ton of ground here. It does remind me somewhat, Nick, do you remember, this might've been like 7 or 8 years ago, and there was like a boom of clothing companies like athleisure, and it's like, oh, there's this huge wave of disruption and they're all going D2C, and so they're going to disrupt all these places. And then it actually turns out, no, it's like you actually need brick and mortar and people want to go in. And so it's like all of these companies raised and it was a whole new business model, but then you realized you needed a whole workforce and everything that existed there. I feel like what you're saying does remind me of that in some way. And I agree more with you where you're saying there's going to be displacement and timing really matters here. But to me, I'm less concerned about new jobs coming on and more the inequality that's going to arise. And so I think it's like new jobs are impossible to predict a priori, right? Unless you can do that successfully, then you're a founder and you're creating the company and you're going to be, you know, extremely, extremely successful. Whereas I think it's much easier to say the future is going to be more lopsided with the winners winning even bigger. But that's not to say everyone else isn't being raised up as well, but there's certainly going to be this steepening impact. And to me, I'm more concerned from the social dynamic of that as opposed to the economic potential of this mismatch in time between jobs and pricing and demand.
It's a very important point. We didn't explicitly touch on it, but I think it's the water we swim in the entire piece, and especially the third piece. My belief is that I think right now AI is an important issue politically, but it is not the issue. It seems like by midterms, it will be a top three issue. And I don't see a world in which by 2028, it is not the only issue that matters if we just straight line out any of these curves. And so I think that's really what we want to get to is this idea that, like, okay, you know, AI, everyone needs to be aware of it. We're seeing it in everyone's life. And, you know, how do we come up with a sort of a new paradigm, if you will, to be able to, you know, not slow it down, to ensure that, you know, we want it to be deployed as fast as possible because it, you know, it's going to bring just amazing bounty to all humanity. But how do we do it in such a way that, you know, that everyone benefits? And, you know, we recognize that the system needs to change a little bit from the old system where ultimately most of the value that you created was just your human labor. And that labor is, you know, in one form or another, just, it's very difficult to paint a picture in which it's going to be worth as much as it was a few years ago.
No, I disagree. Wait. If GDP explodes and then there still remains a labor component of GDP, labor becomes the, call it, scarcer resource. And so then the labor component that remains gets compensated much more, at least on a real basis, because kind of the cost of goods declines. You have technological deflation and the kind of
so
like
GDP needs to explode, right? That's the if.
But right? That's your entire scenario is GDP is growing at like 10%, which we agree with. We think that could happen. And then therefore there's a consumption collapse, which I don't think that's mathematically possible. I just don't think you can have those, even in the like math that the piece lays out, where it's like labor share falls from, you know, you say 54% to 46% or something. If you do marginal propensity to consume times labor versus capital, you still end up with 6% consumption growth. But
no, come on, you don't actually believe that, Brett. If like the average 100K worker loses their job and the average person that has 250 million in assets gets an extra 100 million in assets, what's going to happen? Is their spending really going to go up, or are they just going to put it in the bank and spend 10%?
They're going to invest it. Like the other issue here is, like, you're saying, where are the jobs coming from? I can point to where they're coming from, the AI labs directly, as in the if you spend $20 million on AI, if you go from spending 5 to 20, right, where does that 20 go? Actually, one of the big concerns in the marketplace is these guys are spending more than their cash flow in investing in AI training data centers, beyond even the inference data centers they need to support it. So if you assume even the $20 million against the inference data centers requires in excess of that to just support that revenue, even at a healthy gross margin for them. It also requires them to pay the SG&A for the people who are selling these enterprise plans out to the enterprises. So it's not like they don't have sales forces. Those still exist. And on top of that, if you look at least the reported numbers for Anthropic and OpenAI, they're spending more on training data centers, so for future products, than they are on current products. So the money going to them is actually, you know, both GDP and consumptive creation. If you really thought that San Francisco housing prices were going to fall on the back of AI, like, gosh, that's where you could make a mint, like, you know, figure out a way to short San Francisco. Because I think if OpenAI IPOs, that two bedroom in, you know, the worst part of San Francisco is going to be more expensive, not less expensive. Do you disagree with that? I mean, do you really, like, money is flowing into those labs and flowing into the labor, flowing into, yes, the capital owners and the investors like us, but it's not just disappearing there. These people have to pay for their, you know, Starbucks venti lattes and their very expensive housing and their very expensive private schools. And they do it on the back of the money that's flowing into the AI labs.
I just believe that, you know, the AI labs are, if you compare what the employment on the AI labs is compared to, like, you know, the broader technology sector and the SaaS sector, right? The ultimately, why is Claude growing so fast? Because people are using it very aggressively. And in the process, they need a lot less of kind of the SaaS software that they buy off the shelf, right? Like, does that mean those businesses collapse overnight? No, of course not. But, you know, when they come to renewal, right, is anyone getting real price increases at renewal for these SaaS businesses? Or are they like, hey, we built a lot of the incremental things on top. We'll give you a little bit more sort of consumption pricing, but, you know, you're never getting price again. And what does that mean to then, you know, that company, that SaaS company's hiring of salespeople, of engineers? And I think the problem is there's just not that many jobs for, you know, there are very, very few jobs in the lab.
No, you're just making up the lack of jobs.
Build the things.
I mean, you're an investor. You see, like,
how do you think about, so Brett, talk to me about Block. Is it all just like overhiring from COVID, or are they really cutting people because they can do a lot more across all their organizations?
Well, yes, I think that for large organizations, like what you're describing is kind of, call it plain vanilla creative destruction. As in, I think that every org is probably bloated on its white collar workforce. I agree with that. And the marginal size of a team can be smaller, and you can ship faster if you have a smaller team. As in, you don't need to coordinate between as many functions in order to get something to market. And so then, as an aggressive corporate leader, the wise thing to do is be like, hey, let's narrow down and hit the set of opportunities ahead of us more aggressively. But what it means is they're kind of like cleaving off some of these opportunities that maybe they're half doing or not doing as well. And it opens up the entrepreneurial marketplace for others to fill in the gap. So will we see more big layoffs like Block's? I don't know. I think Jack also tends to overhire. But I think that you're right that kind of like these big incumbents are going to try to take margin and not hire, right? And I think that's just going to open up one, opportunities for, you know, entrepreneurs to do more stuff. And two, it means you're going to have this huge infrastructure build out that also provides a lot more labor demand and money for consumption.
Yeah, a lot. I actually do think it's like, to echo Brett's point there, all these companies are bloated, and I think notoriously bloated, even without AI. It's like they could have.
Yeah.
It's like, forget AI. All these companies could wipe all these things out, but AI actually offers an opportunity for the people who are laid off and the economy to grow, as opposed to, it's like, if you did this in 2018, pre-AI, you know, inflection point, and that, I think that would have been far worse for the economy than the dynamic we're at today.
AI doesn't change the success rate of entrepreneurship, or it shouldn't. I mean, maybe it increases it a bit.
It makes it, sure.
Yeah, maybe it makes it better, but it doesn't change the fact that, yes, these people can go out, start a business. Does that, you know, give them a $500,000 salary or $200,000 salary that they were previously getting at one of these tech companies? Like, I feel like I agree that there's, if we're all agreeing that every company is bloated, and that AI could force layoffs across the board, like what we've just seen with Blocked, how do you retrain and rehire that workforce before there's some sort of problem, i.e., you know, a spike in unemployment, which I think is the point of your piece here, Alap. And I'm curious, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of this, you're writing part three. So how do you think about potential solutions, if that is the purpose of part three, to look through to some of the solutions to the scenario you laid out?
I don't want to give away too much, but at a high level, the idea is that, you know, we built a bunch of things to make it hard for humans to go from one job to the other in the U.S., you know, in terms of the way our benefit system and our healthcare system works. So we obviously need to address that. Additionally, you know, we tax labor more than we tax AI right now, which is kind of crazy if you just think about, you know, the Social Security assessment that employers pay. So that's another pretty obvious thing we should focus on. But at a high level, the thing that we need to think through is, okay, where are the new jobs going to be created? What categories are they going to be created in? How do we make it easy for folks to reskill and retrain into those categories? How do we incentivize that? And then ultimately, you know, how do we get everyone, the entire economy, to really learn about AI and really figure out how to deploy it? Because, you know, the things that AI can directly do, humans are going to be doing a lot less of. You know, the orchestration of the AI and, you know, using human judgment together with AI to get things done, that's going to take a lot longer. Hopefully it will be a really long time till it can be done without humans. And so part of this is getting, you know, the entirety of the populace just a lot more up the curve in terms of how to use AI and deploy it, you know, at work and at home. And I think we're seeing a lot. I'm sure you guys are seeing the OpenClaw in China stuff happening over the last week. I think, you know, another place where, like, you know, it's really incumbent on us as a country to really push our own advantages there and, you know, just get everyone skilled up in that, I think is a big part of it as well.
I think there's one way to think about that. Oh, yeah. Okay. When's your piece coming out? Yeah.
In the next week or so.
Great. I think, you know, it's funny I hear you say, Nick, retrain and reskill. Like, imagine you have an organization and you are like, I need to cut some heads here. So then you know, try to select intelligently for the people who are most capable. And part of the way you're doing so is you're implicitly selecting for people who are already aggressively using AI, because, like, those are the more productive people, right? And so then these people get, like, spit out of the organization. Now, what's going to happen to those people is they're going to realize, well, gosh, I better get up to speed with using this stuff, because this is the only way I can compete. And so it's going to be a forcing function for them to actually use it to be productive. Like, you have this magical productivity delivering technology. People who aren't using it aggressively are going to get mercilessly clipped out of the workforce unless they begin using it. And so it's going to drive, one, more AI consumption, and two, it's going to drive productivity statistics in the US, because the spot that person ends up is going to be a spot where they previously knowledge worker who was happy to splash around in the pool and type emails with one hand is actually going to be using AI to be more productive. And so I think the high level concern I have, Alap, is you say, we want to encourage this thing to not be held back, for us to use it as much as possible. It's clearly going to be magical productivity delivering. Certainly the tactical way to do that is not to say, and by the way, it's going to take everybody's job and we're going to be all on the dole and on the street as the economy grows. That's actually a way to inspire the kinds of New York State bills, which I think are horrifying and terrible, that prevent AI models from giving any kind of medical podiatry, you know, therapists. Like, they basically try to ring fence off these gilded professions from being threatened by these things. And those bills are going to kill people if they pass. Like, the worst possible outcome here is that the political anxiety around technological unemployment, which there always exists in every transition point in history and never comes to pass, this technological employment. It's like your ghost GDP. It's like, where is it? You know, it doesn't happen. But you could inspire enough anxiety that people are like, we really need to control this stuff. And by controlling it, they could try to kill it. And they might, or they might kill it for the state of California, or Europe probably will kill it, but they're done for anyway, you know, and that would be net bad for humanity and for employment and for abundance. It would really be a bad outcome, I think.
I think we're in violent agreement. I think the risk of us putting out a piece that warns of one way things could go if we're not careful is many orders of magnitude smaller than, you know, should this start actually happening. And we as a society and we as a polity are unprepared for how to deal with it. And so that was the intent of putting it out there. You know, we'll follow up shortly with part three. But I think, you know, even if there, you know, the way we write this explicitly, like even if there's a 10% chance of this specific scenario coming out, it will mean that our actual AI deployment and our timelines and the way we regulate it is so much worse than it otherwise could be. And it's something that is completely preventable. And so part of this is, you know, how do we get different parts of society to really start thinking about this? How do we get, you know, DC to really engage? Because, you know, it's a very solved problem.
Do you think that AI should be directly regulated? I don't understand why we shouldn't have a set of rules of what people can and can't do. And this is just a tool and just, you know, let people use it as they will.
I'm not advocating that AI specifically be regulated. This is much more of a, how do we structure our economy and our system of taxes for a world in which, you know, let's say there is, you know, right now there's this much machine intelligence and this much human intelligence. And, you know, in 3 years, if, you know, we have more machine intelligence than we do human intelligence, what does that mean? Because like the entirety of our society is structured on this idea that human intelligence is the be all end all. And that is changing faster than any of us are actually, you know, able to deal with right now, especially as a society.
Alap, you mentioned 10% odds. Kalshi has the market, and it's, you know, call it, it's a subset of everything you went through, but it's at least three of, you know, certain scenarios.
It's all the negative things. It's basically like, yes, you can have a great recession. That's possible, but you can't have it while you have 10% GDP growth. They're mutually inconsistent. But anyway, go on, tell us the Kalshi market.
But it's currently sitting at 16% odds. Does that feel too high to you? In terms of, it's at least three of, unemployment rate exceeds 10%, S&P 500 declines more than 30% from its closing level of issuance on that market, Zillow Home Value Index declines more than 10% year over year in any of New York City, LA, San Francisco, Chicago, Houston, Phoenix, labor share of gross domestic income, GDI, first release value for any quarter falls below 50%, and a few more.
Well, I did not know that Kalshi existed. Again, I'm an optimist. I think we're going to figure this out. I think that number is absolutely too high, but we have some real work to do figuring it out in the interim.
But that number could be fine, but conditional on GDP growth plus 10%, there's 0.000% chance that happens.
Yeah. So again, we wanted to be a little provocative. GDP goes up before it goes down. But the point is, like, productivity growth will absolutely zoom. GDP growth is a function of how GDP is distributed, including the consumer economy. And that's a much tougher putt than just saying productivity growth is up 10%. What happens to GDP growth if we don't adjust? That's a little trickier in our book.
Okay. Fair.
All right. Alap, where should people find you so they can be notified right away when part three, the optimistic one, which will surely get as many clicks at the June day one?
Yeah.
Where should they follow you?
I'm on X at AlapShah1, AlapShah1, and then the same on Substack as well.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And maybe we'll we'll reconvene after the next piece to go through that as well.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK, and investors should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.